Okay, so this is going to be a course of concerning applications of the latest findings in the theory of Langlands program to analytic number theory. And so I will, in the first half hour of today, I will adumbrate some of the main conjectures, outline rather vaguely the approach I will take. And this will be by no means a comprehensive an outline like Henry gave. It'll be more or less a vague outline, but I will add to this outline later on as we progress. So the main thing that I'd like to kind of focus on is firstly the Sato-Tate conjecture. Secondly, the Ramanujan conjecture. And thirdly, the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. So these are the three conjectures which will act like kind of guiding posts along the way, and we'll focus our attention and see what how the knowledge of analytic continuation of these symmetric power L functions will give us information about these conjectures. So let me first outline what the Sato-Tate conjecture is. So if you take an elliptic curve E, let's say over any number field, you could do this over a number field or a function field even F. And what you do is you look at for each place, finite place, V. You would look at the group of modulo V, the elliptic curve over the place V, and you can write the number of points as the norm of V plus 1 minus some number A sub V. So this more or less defines the number A sub V. And A sub V satisfies what's called Haase's inequality, 2 times the norm of V to the 1/2. And one would like to study, for example, finer properties of these numbers A sub V. And there are many conjectures in number theory that try to focus attention on these numbers A sub V. One of them happens to be the Sato-Tate conjecture. So the fact of the matter is that the number A sub V can be written as a sum of two other numbers. A sub V can be written as norm V to the half. Let's call it alpha V plus beta V, where alpha V is going to be either I, let's say theta V, and beta V is going to be the complex conjugate. So the question is now, for each prime V or place V, these are finite places. We've associated a number theta V, and we would like to know as V varies how these numbers are distributed. So the angle can be taken, uniquely it'll be one could take it between 0 and pi. And as v runs over all the prime numbers, the question would then be, how are these numbers distributed? Now, classically, there's a general method outlined by Hermann Weyl to study the distribution of numbers, uniform distribution of numbers modulo 1. So let me just recall Weyl's theorem. Given a sequence of numbers, real numbers, like so, we would like to study how they're distributed modulo 1. So we will say that they're uniformly distributed. So given a sequence of numbers, x sub n, from 1 to infinity, we will say the sequence is uniformly distributed modulo 1. If for any pair of numbers alpha and beta, with alpha less than beta, and we'll say 0 less than alpha less than beta less than 1, the number of subscripts little n up to capital N with the property that xn lies in this interval alpha beta, we're taking these numbers modulo 1. That means we take the fractional part. So we count, for any two numbers, alpha and beta, we count the number of little n's up to capital N, such that x sub little n lies in this given interval. And if this is asymptotic to the length of the interval, beta minus alpha, times n, as n goes to infinity, we'll say that the sequence is uniformly distributed. Yeah, for all alpha beta. Sorry, oh, for all, yes. For all alpha beta. Thank you. For all pairs alpha and beta, alpha less than beta, we have this property. Yeah. Now, Hermann Weyl's contribution to the study of uniform distribution of sequences is a beautiful criterion that he came up with. So this is the Weyl criterion. So the sequence x sub n, 1 to infinity, is uniformly distributed modulo 1 if and only if this infinite collection of exponential sums is little of capital N for all m greater than or equal to 1. So as n tends to infinity. So it's a beautiful criterion which enables us to determine when a sequence is uniformly distributed by just checking whether or not these exponential sums have the required, little low estimate. Now, going back to the elliptic curve context, we could ask ourselves whether the Weyl criterion can be applied or not. And before I do that, maybe I just make a brief remark about how one would go about proving the while criterion. So here's a little two-line sketch of the proof. So if I want to, let's say, go this way, so I know that all these exponential sums satisfy the required little lower estimate, and I would like to show that the sequence is uniformly distributed according to the definition above. What you would do is just take a characteristic function of the interval, so let chi sub I be the characteristic function of the interval I, and using Fourier analysis, one could write down trigonometric polynomials, let's say, for any fixed k, in fact, one can find trigonometric polynomials, little m of x and capital M of x, with the property that the characteristic function is dominated below and above by these functions. So M of x would be some trigonometric polynomial of the shape M a sub n e to the 2 pi I n x, and up to capital K, let's say. Capital M of x would be summation b sub n e to the 2 pi I n x with capital N up to k, and the constant term a0 and b0 will be the length of the interval, so the length of the interval plus an error term of 1 over k. And one could actually do this. I will leave that as a kind of an exercise using basically Fourier series. You could just do that. And so once you have such a setup, it's rather easy to prove that these once you have all these little o estimates, you can just now show that the number of n less than capital N, such that xn lies in this interval I, it's just simply the summation chi sub I of x sub n. And then from that, we just plug in the upper bound thing, write this thing as a trigonometric sum, put the trigonometric series inside, and oops, I've got bad notation, so let me just put M here, B sub M, X sub N, N up to capital N, and all these sums inside are little o of capital N, except for the first one, corresponding to M equal to 0, and you end up getting that this is equal to B0 plus little o of n, and b0 is just the measure of the interval over there with an error term, says with k going to infinity, this is okay, and the same thing is true for the lower bound. And as far as the upper bound, or the other direction is concerned, you would take for any continuous reasonably smooth function, so take any continuous function for any function in your interval 0 to 1, say like something like that, what you would do, this is my function f, say, and what you would do is you would approximate it by step functions in the usual obvious fashion, And so you can take any function f of x and write it as a linear combination ci chi sub ii of x plus an error term. So let me just say something approximated by step functions. And an error would be at most something like big O of epsilon. You could make sure that the deviation of the function from the step function is at most epsilon by making finer and finer partition of the interval. So you do something like that, and then then choose for the choice f of x equal to e to the 2 pi I mx. You can, having the information that it's uniformly distributed and this, the knowledge that the number of x sub n's that lie in a certain interval is asymptotic to the length of the interval times the number of elements, you can just go back and plug this back in here, and everything would work out. Okay, so I'll leave that as an exercise. There's a... Pardon me? B0? Oh, B0 times n, of course. Yes, thank you. Yeah, B0 times n. There are a couple of remarks I can make about this thing. For some of us who devote their life to the study of error terms, it's important sometimes in questions of this nature to have effective versions of this, and this is what I was alluding to here. The first version of such an effective version of the Weyl distribution theorem was worked out by Erdős and Turan using very precise characteristic functions. And the streamlined version, I believe, with the optimal constants is due to Boiling. And I think in an unpublished paper, I think Selberg also more or less had this the same kind of optimal function for the effective version of Weyl criterion. Now, so we'll try and apply this Weyl criterion to this context of trying to understand the distribution of the theta v's. So so let's apply the Weyl criterion to study the distribution of the theta v's. Now, elliptic curves come in two packages, or two classes, two categories. The elliptic curve has a group law on it, and so one could study the endomorphisms of the elliptic curve, and if you look at the ring of endomorphisms of an elliptic curve, there are either the obvious maps are always there, like multiplication by n. Take a point and just add the point n times, you get another point. So these maps are clearly endomorphisms of the elliptic curve, and they're always there. But sometimes you're lucky, and the endomorphism ring is larger than the ring of integers, and in that case, in that context, one can actually show that the ring of endomorphisms is an order in an imaginary quadratic field. Let's say K. little k. And in this context, when the ring of endomorphisms is larger than the ring of integers, we call it E has complex multiplication. So this is a CM case, and this is the non-CM case. Now, in the CM case, Hecke proved a beautiful theorem, going back and connecting myself to the earlier lecture of Jim Cogdell. Hecke actually proved a fundamental theorem about elliptic curves with complex multiplication by showing, well, I think you have to combine a little bit of Deuring's work, but that the alpha v and the beta v that I've defined there are Hecke characters. So the map are Hecke characters. So in particular, the L function of the elliptic curve, which I have not defined, is essentially a product of these two Hecke L functions, but that's not, we don't need L functions of elliptic curves at the moment. The fact that these are Hecke characters means that there's well, let's not worry about definitions, but a Grosin character, some sort of a generalized character, which we will no doubt meet in later lectures, chi, so that alpha v is really chi of the place v, and beta v is the complex conjugate. And the L function, the Hecke L function corresponding to chi, so this is the Hecke L function attached to a Grosin character, Hecke showed that in many ways these L functions behave like classical Dirichlet L functions. So Hecke showed that LS chi extends to the entire complex plane, satisfies a functional equation similar to the kind of functional equations that Jim Cogdell wrote down on Tuesday, extends to all S and C, satisfies a functional equation, and more importantly, it doesn't vanish in the region real part S greater than or equal to 1. So it's kind of like a non-vanishing theorem reminiscent of the case of the Riemann zeta function, not vanishing on the line real part S equals 1. So this is a very beautiful and fundamental theorem of Hecke. Now if you take a Hecke character chi and you multiply two Hecke characters, chi 1 and chi 2, you get another Hecke character. So this automatically applies to any power of the Hecke character. So this is true for all M. Okay. Now, this particular piece of knowledge is sufficient for us to deduce that in this context of CM elliptic curves, these theta v's are uniformly distributed, and we can apply the Weyl criterion. For that, we need an application of the Tauberian theorem. So let me refresh your memory on how one would extract from information of this type information about the exponential sums behaving, being little o of n. So we have the Wiener-Ikahara-Tiberian theorem. The quintessence of probably a century of analytic number theory condensed beautifully into one neat little package. Let f of s be a Dirichlet series with non-negative coefficients, so real coefficients, and suppose g of s is another Dirichlet series with maybe complex coefficients, but suppose that bn is less than or equal to an for all n, or all n sufficiently large is also okay, and assume that both f of s, g of s extend to real part of s greater than or equal to 1, extend analytically to real part s greater than or equal to 1, except possibly at s equals 1, where they have a simple pole. Well, I don't like to say it like that. Well, where they may have a simple pole, with residue capital R and little r respectively, okay, so R, little r, capital R could be 0. There may not be a pole. By now you should have memorized the Weyl criterion, because I'll use it, so I'm rubbing it off here. Okay, so the conclusion of the theorem is that summation bn less than x is asymptotic to r times x. Oops, little r times x. As x goes to infinity. So that's the conclusion of the theorem. Now, the classical application, meaning the application that motivated the development of this particular theorem, is the prime number theorem. There you would take f of s to be minus zeta prime of zeta of s, which can be written as a Dirichlet series with non-negative coefficients, lambda n being log p when n is a prime power and 0 otherwise. And we take g of s to be the same thing. So take g of s to be f of s and apply the theorem. then you end up getting that, well, you have to show that the Riemann zeta function doesn't vanish on the line, has analytic continuation to the line 1 and doesn't vanish on that line. And that's what you can do that. Analytic continuation is not difficult. The non-vanishing part is, as most of you know, based on a high school exercise, namely 3 plus 4 cos theta being plus cos 2 theta being non-negative. So you get that the zeta function doesn't vanish on the line real part s equals 1, and all of this kind of combines to give you the prime number theorem, because the residue at s equals 1 for the zeta function is 1. So this is just that. So you apply that and get that. The same thing, the same logic applies to the Dedekind zeta function. Now, in the context that we're interested in, the context of elliptic curves, Hecke's theorem there tells us that all these Hecke L functions, so here the Hecke L function would be written out as an Euler product over all the places V. Like so. And all of these are absolute value 1 from the very definition. Therefore, the L function certainly converges absolutely for real part s strictly bigger than 1. And by Hecke's theorem, it extends to real part s equal to 1. And it doesn't vanish there. And therefore, immediately by Hecke and the Tauberian theorem, we deduce, so we're applying the Tauberian theorem applied to minus L prime over L s chi to the m. We deduce so when you're applying the Tauberian theorem, this would be my G, and this would be my G. The F would be the Riemann zeta function. Okay, so I just leave that aside. And what you end up getting is chi to the M of V, norm V up to X, is little o of pi of X. Technically, I have to put a log norm V in here, is little o of X. This is what you would deduce with the immediate application of the Tauberian theorem. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. Then by using partial summation, now this is an adjective. Is it a noun or a verb? Or I'm not sure, but it's certainly used as a verb in analytic number theory. So what people mean by this is that every time you have let's say you have numbers C sub n, and we look at the partial sums, summation C sub n less than x, and call those capital S of x. Supposing we knew something about these partial sums, then partial summation tells you that if you have some sort of continuous function, I shouldn't use f, h, some sort of continuous function h, then I could write this as C of X, S of X times H of X minus the integral from 1 to X S of t h prime of t dt. So if I knew something about these sums, then I can deduce information about the asymptotic behavior of the weighted sum with weighting given by some sort of continuous differentiable, some sort of differentiable function h. And we have a similar situation here. Here we know all about these sums. For every m greater than or equal to 1, we have information about these sums. And here's my kind of continuous function, which I'd like to kind of get rid of. So this is the, these are my sums c sub n, and I'd like to eliminate them. So by choosing something like h of x being 1 over log x, I can eliminate it. And using this technique, you can deduce, we deduce that summation norm v up to x chi the m of v is little o of pi of x. And if we think about it, that's exactly Weyl's criterion applied to the sequence of theta v's. And the methods used to derive the prime number theorem, the same methods, more or less, applied in this context, allow us to deduce the uniform distribution of the angles of all the theta v's. So we get the uniform distribution of the theta v's in the CM case. Okay, so this is how one would go about doing something like this. Now, in the non-CM case, Sato and Tate independently observed that the theta v's are not uniformly distributed with respect to the Lebesgue measure on the unit interval. Noticed that, I mean, I have to quantify this word noticed, I'll explain that in a second. Notice that for non-CM curves, the theta v's do not seem to be uniformly distributed. Modulo 1. And what they noticed is, more precisely, they predicted that the number of places whose norm is less than x, with the property that theta v lies in a sector or an interval alpha beta, this number is asymptotic to not the length of the interval, but this kind of altered length with respect to this measure. Maybe I shouldn't use x sine squared theta d theta times pi of x. I think I used f for my field, so pi sub f of x, which is the number of prime ideals whose norm is up to x. So this is what they noticed experimentally. If it were uniformly distributed, you'd expect beta minus alpha here, but you don't have that. You get this. And Sato's analysis was all numerical, using computations and noticing that this was not the Kate. And Tate's analysis was more theoretical in the sense that he was trying to understand the Birch-Soon and Dark conjectures in a larger context and formulated his celebrated conjectures about algebraic cycles on varieties and trying to relate them to the orders of zeros and poles of these exotic zeta functions attached to varieties. So from that standpoint, he was led to making the same conjecture. As of today, this is still unproved, but it's certainly been the great muse of much of the Langlands program, and I'll try and explain how it fits in with the symmetric power L functions. Now, one thing for sure, maybe in the next 15 minutes or so, we can show with some knowledge that, in fact, in the non-CM case, the theta Vs are not uniformly distributed Mod 1. This much we can do using Wild's criterion, because all you have to do is show that one of those exponential sums is violates the property, and that happens at m equals 2, thanks to Rankin and Selberg. So that part is okay, but the other part is the more difficult part. Now, the paper that I've alluded to of Tate, I think it goes to the early 60s. It's the Woods Hole Conference. The algebraic cycles and poles of zeta functions. Now, in that paper, he made conjectures, more precise conjectures about orders of poles, and there are more higher dimensional versions of the Sato-Tate conjecture which one can find, which are worth studying from the standpoint of the Langlands program, which I plan to do later on at the end of this course. Now, in 1972, I think, Langlands wrote a beautiful paper, more or less, or 1970, wrote a beautiful paper called Problems in the Theory of Automorphic Forms, and I compare this paper to that 8-page paper of Riemann, where he outlines how to prove the prime number theorem. In this paper, Langlands outlines how ideas from representation theory can be used to prove A, the Sato-Tate conjecture, B, the Ramanujan conjecture, and C, the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. So let me kind of give you a quick description. As I said, this is kind of an outline rather than a more precise version. In Henry Kim's talk, we will meet more precise definitions of the symmetric power L functions, but for the time being, let me give you an unmotivated definition. So, let's define M minus 2J, M minus J, beta V power J, norm V to the S, inverse. Let's define these L functions. For each M, let's define these. You may wonder why, and I'll tell you why later. But let's just define them, because these appear in the paper by Langlands. And Langlands notes that if each of the L sub M of S's extend analytically to well, real part s greater than or equal to 1 for all m's, and do not vanish there. Then the Sato-Tate conjecture is true. So this is what. Now I think to be accurate, that's one drawback here. We can't run to the library and check that certain things. I wanted to check this morning whether or not he made this exact statement. This is the statement as I read from Sayre's paper. I think in his original paper he just says extend it as an entire function, period. And I think Sayre noticed that you don't need extending it to the entire complex plane. Real part s bigger than or equal to 1 is enough. And non-vanishing there is pointed out by Sayre. Then you get that Sato-Tate conjecture is true. And then Kumar Murthy proved that the non-vanishing hypothesis can be eliminated from this. Non-vanishing hypothesis not needed. Because if you have analytic continuation of all these L functions to the line 1, then a superb generalization of this high school inequality for certain, you know, concoct some nth degree trigonometric polynomial and you show it's non-negative, exploiting such trigonometric inequality, you can show that the non-vanishing pops out. Now this is the most expedient way I can define these L functions, and so as to tell you what are the latest discoveries in this theory that we want to focus on. Now, I use the context of elliptic curves to make the definition of these L functions, but the fact of the matter is the Sato-Tate conjectures arose in the context of elliptic curves, but it was Sayre who points out that these really have nothing to do with elliptic curves, probably are general phenomena of modular forms. So you could take a modular form, which is a Hecke eigenform, and define these L functions exactly analogously in that context of Hecke eigenforms, and you would expect the same kind of Sato-Tate distribution for Hecke eigenforms. And I think it. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. It fits in the following sense. Half of them are zero, all right, but because I cleverly chose my number field K, and the split primes will correspond to two ideals. And so because half of them are zero, I'm not counting them actually in this setup. You're right. If I were to work over the rational numbers, I would have to worry about that. And what people normally do, I think this is what Hecke did and what Deuring did. They took away the primes that don't split, because for those it's AP zero anyway. And for the primes that split, they just considered those ones and then showed that they were uniform in that subcollection. Okay, so that's. But here, so that I didn't have to discuss that, I was working over the quadratic field so that the primes that split come in two, and they compensate for the primes that are normally left out. Yeah, so that's right. So if you just concern yourself only with the split primes, they are uniformly distributed in that class. Yeah, that's what comes out of that thing. Yeah, good question. Now, okay. So what's known about what's known about this, so what's known about these L sub m's? So for m equals 1, as I mentioned, if you have an elliptic curve over Q, and if it's coming from a modular form, or you start from a modular form, it goes back to Hecke theory discussed Tuesday by Jim, Hecke theory. So these are classical. The L function attached to m equals 1 corresponds to an L function attached to a modular form. And for those, we have analytic continuation, as was proved. But the non-vanishing was not proved. And so that's actually a theorem of Rankin, non-vanishing. So Hecke theory plus Rankin. So for m equals 2, it's essentially Rankin and Selberg, who showed that the Riemann zeta function times L2SF, times L2 of S, the way I've defined it. And I suppose it's not the Riemann zeta function, but it's the zeta function of the field that I'm working over. This is regular for real part of S greater than or equal to 1, except where it has a simple pole. And because the zeta function has a simple pole, we deduce that the L2 of S doesn't have any pole. So this implies that L2 of S is regular for real part of S. At least that much it can be deduced from Rankin-Selberg. So there was this problem of removing the zeta function from the picture that was done by Shimura in the classical case of modular forms, and the general case was done by Gelbart and Jacquet. Yeah. So Shimura in the classical case, so this is still m equals 2, Shimura in the classical case, and Gelbart Jacquet in the general automorphic context show that L2 of S is entire, extends to an entire function. And for m equals 3, this is a theorem of Kim and Shahidi. So L3 of S extends to an entire function. Actually, their results are stronger, but I'm stating them in this kind of funny way, as I said, for the sake of expediency. These things are actually automorphic L functions, and that's a stronger theorem. It is an entire function. And m equals 4. Henry Kim's theorem. Same thing, L4 is entire. And automorphic. And then for 5 up to 9, Kib and Shahidi have shown that this extends is regular. Well, extends to a mirror morphic function for the entire complex plane. So maybe extends to a mirror morphic function for all S and C. And in particular, it is regular for real part S greater than or equal to 1. Regular for real part of S. I believe there are no poles at S equals 1. Is that true?
Except for 9.
Except for 9, okay. Except for 9. Regular regular for real part S equals bigger than or equal to 1. And for L9 of S, may have a pole, although it shouldn't, may have a pole at S equals 1. If it does, then Sato Tate is out the door. Yeah. Why is Sato Tate out the door if there's a pole? So, this is because there's a generalization of the Weyl uniform distribution theorem for compact groups. And one can set this up in the context of compact groups, and this is a formulation due to Sayre. In the context of L functions. So let G be a compact group. And compact groups have a nice Haar measure with Haar measure mu. And suppose that we have a sequence of elements of the group Xm. I should be a little careful. Let G be a compact group and let X be the space of conjugacy classes. So X is the space of conjugacy classes. So each n, I'm associating a conjugacy class of the group G. So I have a sequence of conjugacy classes. Then we say the sequence is uniformly distributed in G or in X if for any measurable subset of X, for any measurable subset I of X, the number of n's up to capital N with the element lying in the measurable subset I is asymptotic to the measure of I times n as n goes to infinity. And the Weyl criteria now is the following. So Weyl's criterion in this context is that the sequence x sub n is uniformly distributed in x if and only if, instead of these exponential sums, you have all these character sums. If and only if summation chi of x sub n as n ranges over all the elements up to capital N is little o of n for all irreducible characters chi of g. So this is a beautiful generalization of the Weyl criterion, because the classical Weyl case is the compact group, the unit circle R mod Z, and there all the characters are given by are indexed by integers m, where x goes to either 2 pi I mx. So these are your characters on this group, and you retrieve the Weyl criterion from this general theorem. And so Sayre has this setup where he now wants to marry together the generalized Weyl criterion for compact groups with the Tauberian theory in the following way. Suppose F is a field, and for each place V, I attach some X sub V in capital X, and then I, for each irreducible representation, complex linear representation, for each irreducible representation, rho, say GLMC or something, we attach the following Artin-like L function so we attach this object. And the theorem, it's more or less now clear what to do. You set the whole thing up like you did in the prime number theorem case. You hypothesize that, suppose that LS rho extends to real part of S greater than or equal to 1 and does not vanish there. By the way, I should have pointed out that the collection of irreducible representations of a compact group is a countable set. Therefore, these are a countable family of L functions. And so for all these countable family, for this collection, we need to assume that it doesn't vanish on the line real part of S equal to 1. Then the sequence X sub V, as V runs over all the prime places of F, is uniformly distributed once this happens. Now, if because the generalized Weyl criterion for compact groups is an if and only if assertion, it follows from the Tauberian theorem that if there were a pole that where it's not supposed to be, you'd get a contribution which would then violate that thing. So it is really an if and only if situation where the Sato-Tate really will be out the door once one of these higher
L functions has a pole. It's really not supposed to. I should explain
where the pseudo-Tate would come from this kind of a picture. Well, the group, according to Sayre, is a special unitary group over the complex numbers, and there the space of conjugacy classes, so let's G be this thing, in the compact group, the space of conjugacy classes is parametrized by, each conjugacy class is a representative of the following shape. So for each theta between 0 and pi, you have a representative of the conjugacy class. So the conjugacy classes are in some sense parametrized by this interval, one-to-one correspondence, and there's an element in that as a representative of the conjugacy class. So for each prime v now, we would associate x sub v to be this matrix or this or the conjugacy class of this this element. And when you look at the irreducible representations of this group, they turn out to be the symmetric powers, symmetric power representations. Rho 0, where rho 0 is the standard representation. So rho 0 is just the standard representation. It's taking the matrix to the matrix, okay? And you take the symmetric power, maybe later on I'll define exactly more precisely what this means, the symmetric power powers of the standard representation. These are all the irreducible representations of the group SU2C. And when you construct the L function attached to the symmetric power representation with this construction a la Sayre, you end up getting exactly L sub M of S, as I defined earlier. And this is the point. So this is the key point. And hence, the uniform distribution with respect to the pseudo-Tate measure is all linked up with the analyticity property of these L functions on the line real part s equals 1. I'll leave this in a second, so I hope you remember that. Now, let me just point out, with reference to the thing that I just rubbed off, for m equals 2, I said that zeta f of s times L2 of s is analytic for real part s greater than or equal to 1, except where it has a simple pole. Where it has a simple pole. And therefore, when you undo this information from the standpoint of the Tauberian theorem, you end up showing that, well, basically you end up showing either 2 pi I theta v norm v less than or equal to x is asymptotically minus x over log x. And let me get this straight. There might be some constants which are not correct.
Yeah, this is correct. So if you take the Rankine-Cell-Bragel function and apply the Tauberian theorem now, you will, from this particular knowledge, you will deduce this fact. Of course, you have to put a few things together later, but you can see that this kind of thing will enter into this picture. And this implies that the theta v's are not uniformly distributed modulo 1 in the classical sense. So definitely this much is proved once you have the Rankine-Cell-Bragel thing in your hands. Exactly. That's the key point. Exactly. Exactly. The image of the Haar measure in X, in the space of conjugacy classes, you have to make a computation, it's not obvious. It's 2 over pi sine squared theta d theta. It's right on, you know. If you like to see where this calculation is done, look at the book by Broeker Tom Deek. Representation theory of compact groups, where you calculate the image of the Haar measure. So it's a reference Broeker. So it works out right exactly to the Sato-Tate measure. That's the amazing thing. And so you would expect these L functions to behave as they're supposed to, as predicted by this generalized Weil criterion. Now, in the time remaining, let me try and indicate the other kind of points that are made in the 1970 paper of Langlands. So one of these concerns theory of Moss waveforms. I think there is. Yeah, you have to. Yeah, you have. I think it's a three-dimensional thing that you have to use. This is not really. It's written down in one of Sarnak's papers. The exact group you'd have to use for. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll check that later.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now on Tuesday, Jim Cogdell told you the definition of a modular form, and he started by defining the extended upper half plane, which is the union of the usual upper half plane with the rational numbers and this point at infinity. And a modular form was then defined as a holomorphic object on this space. Now, if you were to drop the holomorphy condition, you get objects what are called Moss waveforms. So, if we consider modular forms, without the holomorphy condition, see, the holomorphy condition is equivalent to saying that the function satisfies the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So we replace the Cauchy-Riemann equations by stipulating that the function is an eigenfunction of the non-Euclidean Laplacian. That's how we extend the definition. So if we take, replace the holomorphy condition by insisting that F is an eigenfunction of the non-Euclidean Laplacian, then we get what are called real analytic modular forms, or real analytic forms. And such a form, so therefore, is going to have, we're going to look at eigenfunctions of this Laplace operator on the upper half space. One can now show that the collection of eigenvalues that are possible is again a discrete set. If we stipulate cuspidality, then let me write down that you can write down a Fourier expansion. So, see, the point is that if you think of the function as a function of real variables x and y, it's still going to be periodic. F of x plus 1 comma y will still be f of x comma y. Therefore, you'll have a Fourier expansion. So the Fourier expansion will be coefficients which may depend on y now. But now we may have to take over all integers, not just non-negative integers. And the fact that f has to satisfy, be an eigenfunction of the Laplace operator, forces some condition on the coefficients, and the coefficients have to satisfy the Whittaker differential equation. So it turns out that when you plug in the eigenfunction condition, you get that. And after a little bit of renormalization, which probably won't get to, one can renormalize. I think I'll just skip the substitutions. One can renormalize and show that f of xy turns out to be a0 of f y of the following shape, a0 prime of f y of the 1 minus s. Plus n not 0 an of f root y k sub I r 2 pi mod n y either 2 pi I and x, where, what is s? Where we're going to write lambda as s times 1 minus s. It tells you what s is. And then the k is the k Bessel function. K Bessel function where lambda now is written as 1/4 plus r squared. Okay, so since I'm running out of time, let me just make a very brief allusion to the Ramanujan conjecture and probably stop. So what we've done is taken the notion of a modular form, dropped the holomorphic thing, and replaced it with the fact that the function should be an eigenfunction of the Laplace operator. The holomorphic modular forms will also be eigenfunctions of this thing. Okay, so we've enlarged our class. And now, just as Hecke was developing his theory of L functions attached to classical modular forms and establishing analytic continuation and functional equation, similarly, Maas, in a parallel universe, was also more or less doing the same. And he shows that the Dirichlet series that you associate to such a form, namely with these Fourier coefficients here, this Dirichlet series extends to an entire function. So I think I start it from 1 to infinity. It doesn't really make it precise this way. This Dirichlet series extends to an entire function and satisfies a functional equation somewhat similar, but not quite, to the functional equations that Jim wrote down on Tuesday. Now, the Ramanujan conjecture in this context which is still unproved is that for any epsilon positive, A sub n is O of n to the epsilon. And the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture is the assertion that lambda is bigger than or equal to a quarter. The significance of Langland's 1970 paper is that it draws one's attention to these two conjectures as being not isolated from the Sato-Tate conjecture in the sense that they are all deducible from analyticity properties of these symmetric power L functions. So in the 1970 paper, Langland points out that instead of talking about classical modular forms, if you use the language of representation theory, automorphic representations of GL2 of the Adele ring of a number field, then it turns out that includes both the classical Hecke modular forms and the Maas waveforms, and that's it for GL2. That more or less this exhausts the theory of automorphic L functions in this context, and from this setup or framework, the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture, so Langland interprets the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture as the Ramanujan conjecture at infinity. Namely, the non-Euclidean Laplacian actually plays the role of some sort of Hecke operator at the infinite prime. And so puts both the conjectures on the same footing. On a conceptually, I say conceptually because it's not identical, it's conceptually equal footing. Okay. And so this means that whenever you make progress in one, you should be able to make progress in the other, and vice versa. Now, the best known result on the Ramanujan conjecture here is, instead of giving the history of everything, I'll just state the final result, An of F, An is O of into the 7 over 64 in the Q case. And this is the work of Kim and Shahidi. And correspondingly, as I said, every time you have a result here, you should have a result here. Correspondingly, this result has been worked out by Kim and Sarnak. And the result is that lambda is at least 0.238. So not that far off from 0.25. Okay, so I think this is probably a good place to stop. I just want to emphasize once more that this paper of Langland's is really full of beautiful ideas, and it appears in the Springer lecture notes. No, not that one. It's a Dudley volume. It's 170. Yeah, let's see. It's 170. You're right. Yeah. It's Lectures in Modern Analysis and Applications. It's edited by Dudley, Richard Dudley. Yeah. And most of them are probability theory papers in that volume. Okay, so I think this is a good place to stop.